Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge introduces incredible stories shared by women across the globe who have experienced the great heights of success and, at times, the agony of defeat. With a vision to impart wisdom and advice on how to tackle barriers and soar to new heights, the show uncovers different perspectives to help you find your inner strength and to power up your own voice so you can excel in life.
Welcome to Women Worldwide. I'm your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Let's talk about the American dream and owning a home today. Are you a homeowner? Well, I am. And as much as I love my home, there's always something that needs to be fixed. Thankfully, my husband is Mr. Fix-It, and he loves to take on those projects. Not me. I'd rather be doing anything else. So what do you do if you own a home, but you don't want to deal with the headaches and the hassles that come with the territory? Well, this is the perfect time to introduce my special guest today. Her name is Shannon Blemker, and she's the CEO and founder of GlassHouse.com. Shannon has extensive experience in residential design, construction management, green building, and home maintenance. She launched Glass House to provide modern home care for today's very busy homeowners. She's here to share her story with you. So Shannon, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Deirdre.
Well, okay, so, you know, I know that you were on Wall Street at one time, and then you ended up focused on your entrepreneurial venture. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got there.
Well, it's kind of a circuitous path, like a lot of modern careers. I was on Wall Street for a number of years and loved it. But when it came time to raising a family, my husband and I were both doing the same job, and it was 80 hours a week, and that was too much for both of us to be doing. So I took a break from that and started doing some consulting work and ultimately went back to grad school. And at that point, I sort of had to decide, you know, did I want to continue working in finance, or did I maybe want to take on something different? And at the time, the whole movement, the green movement, was budding and blossoming, and, you know, An Inconvenient Truth had just gotten launched and everybody was talking about it. And one of the new departments at Harvard that was sort of up and coming was the sustainability degree. And so I decided that that was something that I had always been sort of passionate about in the background. I grew up in Southern California. We always focused on things like organic foods and recycling. And, you know, I thought that this was a perfect time to really round out that whole knowledge base. And so I went back and got my graduate degree and started working on green building and doing sort of lead design and consultation and really trying to see where it could go from there. And ultimately what I recognized in the construction industry was that while we were doing a good job with trying to incorporate more eco-friendly materials into things and really trying to look at energy initiatives and conservation components, that we hadn't really done a great job with very ordinary things like making sure that the building was cared for over time, that there was an adequate maintenance plan in place, and that was going to be more of an effect on how sustainable that building was, whether it was cared for, than any of the other components that had gone into it initially being built. And so my husband and I were working in the single-family rental business for a number of years and continued to work on investments in real estate, and I decided I really wanted to tackle the single-family market and try and improve the experience that regular homeowners have with their largest investment by really creating something that I thought was focused on sustaining that structure and really being true to the values of what we go into home ownership for, that we intend to buy this piece of real estate as an investment and keep it, you know, in as good a condition as we can, both for ourselves so that we don't have the hassle trying to take care of all kinds of things, but also because ultimately we're going to sell it. We're just stewards of that house for a small period of time. They usually outlive us. So, you know, how can we do a more responsible thing for ourselves and then also ultimately for the home itself by trying to take care of it over time?
Well, that makes so much sense. I just wonder, how hard is it to get others to recognize that you need to be thinking proactively about your largest investment? Because so many people, like myself, you know, fall into that trap of, oh, gonna let it go. And then all of a sudden, and not so much with my home now, but I remember my first home was a complete money pit. So it really makes sense. But was it hard to educate people?
Oh, it's so hard. I mean, it's still so hard. And that's a lot of what we do, is create these sort of thought leadership pieces where we're really trying to educate the community at large about it. And, you know, I use the car industry as an analogy a lot. You know, back when auto manufacturers were first inventing cars, they would expect you to take care of it. You were supposed to, you know, crawl under the hood and replace spark plugs and, you know, get the oil changed by literally doing it yourself. And, you know, that industry has sort of grown up and matured to the point where nobody changes their own oil anymore, and you almost couldn't, the way the engines are encapsulated. And there's a whole maintenance and service division that is actually more profitable than even sales for most of the car manufacturers. So I think it's a slow process. I'd like it to be a little quicker than the many, many decades it took the car industry. But I think that those parallels start to make sense to people, that you do spend about 5% of your car's value on maintenance every year, and it's a depreciating asset, whereas your home can actually appreciate in value, and we generally just wait until something breaks before we fix it. So trying to get people to recognize that if you did something more proactive, chances are you're going to save money in the end. It's really about just trying to outreach to them and educate them, and also about giving them a solution. So you can tell them it's important to do this preventative maintenance, and they might listen to you, but if you give them a plan and a company that would help them do it, it's a whole lot easier to do.
Well, that's really interesting. What does a plan, I mean, I know that every home would be different, but what would a plan look like? Is the plan focused on making sure that your windows and your roof are in good shape? Can kind of share what that would look like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of things. And so, yes, every home is different, but, you know, every home has a heating system, and every home tends to have a refrigerator and laundry facilities. And so, you know, making sure that those appliances work properly and that they have, you know, their filters changed, and that the, you know, water fixtures, water is the primary cause of damage in homes. So any of the sources of water, checking for things like leaks, you know, working on the water heater and making sure that you're, you know, changing out the sedimentation water at the bottom of it. I mean, they're simple things. If you picked up any home maintenance manual, it would tell you to check for these things. It would tell you to look for signs of termites. It would tell you to look for, you know, peeling on the paint on the siding of your house so it doesn't produce dry rot later. Most of us just don't have time, or, you know, we're wandering around our house, but we don't recognize whether or not that's a problem. And, you know, ultimately, you just really need somebody who knows more than you do to take a look at it from time to time. And we just don't do it. You know, we have a home inspection when we buy the house, and then again when we sell it. And, you know, chances are something happened to that home over that time that maybe could have been prevented if somebody had seen it earlier. So the goal is really to have sort of a professional eyes on, I call them an asset manager for your house, you know, your largest asset, because they really are an expert that's helping you take care of it. And that's kind of where I see that going. So there is a list of things that are just sort of normal, responsible, check on it kinds of things, again, focused on water. And then, yes, every home is custom. So if you happen to have solar panels, or my house happens to have gray water, or, you know, you have, I don't know, an outdoor kitchen or something like that, there's always, you know, deviations from that. And there's always things that just come up, normal wear and tear. So, you know, having a person that's sort of your go-to for everything and that keeps a digital record of all the work that was done is really sort of a helpful benefit.
And is that person doing the work? So rather than hiring the handyman and then time slips by and then you have to go search for another handyman, you know, it's more like you have a partner. That's kind of what it sounds like.
It is. That it is a person that does the work. So it's sort of cutting out that whole chasing your tail to try and find a different person to do every little task. That's part of why I call them an asset manager, because they're really your go-to resource for things. And anything they can't do that's just too big for them, they can help you find the expert that you need to do it. And they can be an advocate for you so that you don't feel like you might get railroaded by somebody telling you you need something that you don't really need.
Interesting. Well, so you had this big career change. What do you think was your biggest adjustment moving? And you had different phases. It was Wall Street, and then you got into the kind of the green building, and then you moved into Glass House, what you're doing now and the service you provide. So what's been the big adjustment as an entrepreneur?
I think the hardest part is, when you work for yourself, when you start your own business, it's very different than working for a huge corporation. You have a lot less resources. You're chief cook and bottle washer, so, you really have to make sure that you can dive in deep to things, and nobody's going to check your work and make sure you actually got the right facts and that you remembered to send the bills in on time. And you're also responsible for creating a team and a culture. Whereas when you join a company that's already existing, you become a part of that culture. That's a whole twist that you don't really think of, that, if you're going to work for someone else, you could come in and be in a surly mood one day and people will just leave you alone. But, when you're in charge of the company and you walk in and you're kind of surly, it really does change the feeling in the whole office space. So I think that's been the biggest adjustment is just how you manage, how you feel every day when you walk into the office, and how you continue to create a place where people want to come to work and want to help you build this new company.
Well, that is definitely so important, because if you don't have people who are excited and passionate and want to come in every day, then, you're not going to have much of.
You're not going to get very far, I'll tell you that.
Exactly. But you made an interesting point. When you're working for somebody else, not that we take for granted, but you walk into a place and things are already existing. So you don't have to think about the culture and the team building, although you may be a part of it. The same kind of goes for marketing your company. Now as an entrepreneur, wow, that's a big eye-opener to all the ways you have to get your company out there. So I guess two-part question. How are you marketing your company? And also just a little bit on, are you using any of the newer media, social media, to build community and establish this thought leadership that you spoke of before?
Well, again, just being small and starting out, you try pretty much everything to figure out, what's the best strategy to go with. And one of the things that we've found recently is that because we're trying to educate people along with trying to allow them to see that there's this new business that's available, we've tried to work with people who are in connection with them. So real estate brokers were an easy person for us to contact, and they get it right away. They're like, oh gosh, we need to give this to all of our people right now. And that's a great marketing vector for us. So coming up with the right messaging to help support them in that. But also working with general contractors, because, again, they've just built you this great house or done this great renovation for you. This is a perfect segue for them to say, okay, now it needs to have this kind of care, rather than handing you a stack of manuals. Couldn't they give you at least an introduction to what this business is and how it could be beneficial, how it might have saved you money from some of the stuff that you had to spend during the construction process? So reaching out to those groups has been a focus for us, but it can also be a challenge. It's a disparate group. Real estate brokers, even the ones that work for big national companies, they are independent contractors. So They're not going to share with the person next to them if they think they have this great thing. You almost have to market to every single one of them separately.
Exactly.
Well, and the contractors are no better. I mean, there's no national contractors. So, really just one at a time trying to hit these groups. And that's been, a real challenge. It's how do you get to this very disparate group? And so sometimes social media works. Sometimes those people are on totally different social media channels than the ones that you're reaching out to. Even the handymen that we recruit and try and hire, a lot of them are not on the same kind of social media. They're not on LinkedIn. They're looking at totally different kinds of things. So I wouldn't say we even had it figured out yet. We're really just trying to work through exactly how to reach these people and what words are resonating the most with the biggest group. Styling and that message, that's the tricky part.
Yeah, definitely. And just, you know, even how you said you're kind of figuring it out with media the way that it is today,
if you did
figure it out, you'd have to figure it out some more because everything keeps changing on us. But,
small businesses, you know, as much as you want to believe in the power of the success that you have at your fingertips and that it's definitely going to work, you don't have the budget to be putting out, you know, TV commercials and, you know, even mailers to everybody on the planet. So, you know, really have to be strategic about where you're going and how you're spending it so that you're not going broke while you're trying to tell people that you exist.
Right. Now, can you meet any of the, you mentioned real estate, contractors, handyman, can you meet these folks on LinkedIn? Are they there at least as professional service providers? Or is that not even applicable?
Yeah, you know, the handyman, not so much. The real estate brokers, you know, you'll get some of the top producers, but they tend to also switch from place to place. So it's not been the easiest way to reach them. The same with the contractors. You won't usually get the people that you need to talk to who are connected on LinkedIn. You'll get maybe their head of the business or, you know, their accountant, so those kind of professionals. So it's really been kind of a needle in a haystack thing at the moment. But some of the conferences, they do have national conferences for a lot of those groups, and being able to speak at some of those things and have booths there, sponsor those events. I mean, I think those are some of the outreach things that are going to be really effective. And allowing the company to sort of grow in a grassroots way so that, you know, when you reach somebody in an area that's outside of where you're currently serving, you can enable that to sort of transpire by itself. So imagine we're in the San Francisco Bay Area right now where we just launched. And if we can meet up with a group of real estate brokers or handymen or contractors in, say, Dallas, then all of a sudden we can be in Dallas and we can offer our services there. And so just being able to reach out to people on a national level, that's been the biggest help with some of the social media and also with some of the PR that we've been able to get, just because we are doing something so different.
Yeah, no, I would think PR would be a big part of what you're doing, the relationship building, as well as, you know, through PR, your branding and your sharing your thought leadership. When you talk about, you know, being in different areas, so do you pick large cities where you're basically building your core base of whether it's, you know, your handyman? How does that work? And how many cities are you looking at?
You know, cities, it's interesting. I know when you say city, you probably mean metropolitan area, and that is kind of, you know, more of what we think too,
yes.
Because even in San Francisco where we launched, we don't serve San Francisco itself. And the reason is because the more urban the area is, the more you tend to have apartments and condos, and you end up having a really high propensity of renters rather than owners. And so it really sort of shifts what you're offering. And so ours is specifically targeted at single-family homeowners, so you're really largely in the suburbs. So the suburban areas in those around those metro centers are really where we think that we're going to be the most active. And so, yes, reaching out to each of those groups, like I said, the GCs that are active in those areas, and also the real estate brokers. And it's a little bit of a chicken and egg thing. You know, you can create the demand for it, but if you can't supply that demand right away,
yes,
then, you know, you're sort of stuck. But if you get all these people on the line who are ready to deliver this service and it takes you 6 months to let people know that you exist, then you may have lost their interest by then. So, you know, that's not unlike a lot of businesses when they're expanding, that, you know, you usually have to create the supply in advance of the demand, but it's not always easy formula to follow.
No, something tells me you're hustling on both ends. You know, Shannon,
you always are. You know, you always feel like you're behind, but then somehow it looks like it's working from the outside. It's kind of like, you know, the hamster is running in a wheel behind the background, but you're trying to create this this persona of, we've got this. We really got this
covered. We got this covered. Shannon, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break to give some love to a sponsor. And when we get back, Shannon will share her thoughts on the busy lifestyle of the entrepreneur and how she stays on track and organized.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge. Segment 2 is coming right up.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Pure Performance Communications works with businesses to move their audiences from interest to action, giving you a roadmap that fosters deeper engagement and forges stronger relationships along the way. Visit us at pureperformance.com. Thank you.
Now, back to Women Worldwide with your host, Deirdre Breckenridge.
Welcome back to the show. Shannon Blemker and I were just chatting about her entrepreneurial journey from Wall Street to what she's doing now, her company, Glass House. So Shannon, we were sort of talking about that whole, you have to create the demand, you have to be thinking about the supply, there's a lot that goes into it. That's a lot of hours. You must be so busy. I'm just kind of wondering the biggest difference between your 80-hour work weeks when you were on Wall Street versus the crazy hours as an entrepreneur.
It's funny because, one of the reasons that I wanted to change careers from Wall Street was because I didn't want to work those 80-hour work weeks anymore. But the thing is, when you own a company, you're never not thinking about that company. So however many hours are in a week, that's how many hours I feel like I'm working, because it just weighs on you. It weighs on you at 2 in the morning that you didn't think of something, or, oh, I really need to solve this problem, or you're, reading an article on Sunday afternoon and you suddenly have this epiphany about a better way to do something. And so you're sending an email to your whole team and you're never off the clock. So I think but it's different. This is something that you're excited to do because you can see the fruits of your labor. When you work on Wall Street, you're scrambling around for somebody else to profit from it. So it really is gratifying, but it is all consuming. And I hate saying that sometimes because it makes it sound like you're a slave to your company and you can't think of anything else. But I actually love it. And I love that my family helps me with it. They help me think of ideas. So I have 4 boys and two of my teenagers are, they're interns for me this summer, and they brought some of their friends in to be interns for me this summer. Like, they really want to help. And that's cool. And my office is not far from my younger kids' elementary school, and they'll come over in the afternoons and say, hi, Mom. And so for me, it doesn't feel like such a slog because I feel like I'm not trading off time that I ordinarily would love to spend with my family. I mean, it's not like we're out bike riding, but at the same time, we're all invested in this, and that feels organic and natural as part of this startup process. If Mom is all consumed with something, let's help Mom. And it probably won't always be this way. This is how it is in the beginning of a business, and then. Once you settle into a pattern that works, then, you sort of dial back how much that you're scrambling around.
Yeah, I love it that your family is invested too, and that you can have your boys come and they bring their friends. That's conquering that, what I call it's really the work-life blend. You're maximizing all parts of your life, and it kind of fits together seamlessly. Well, you also said slave to your company. It's very clear, no matter what, when you have a career, you are a slave. So wouldn't you rather, I know as an entrepreneur, I'd rather be a slave to my own company. So I think you're saying that as well.
Yeah, no, it's true. And you feel like you really will see the benefits of it, even if for whatever reason your company ends up going in a different direction. You personally have grown so much as a result of being invested in it and taking this to the next level that you're not going to regret it later on.
Right, exactly. Okay, so we've definitely established that no matter what the brain is going, you might be jumping into something, you know, whether it's later in your day or at night or 2 o'clock in the morning. So it sounds like super busy, busy days, busy nights. What are you doing to keep on track and organized?
I would love to say I was very organized, but the truth is you're never that organized. So, you know, use as many tools as are available, you know, to everyone. You use all kinds of mobile-based apps and calendaring functions and reminders and things like that. But, you know, I find that what helps me a lot is to share some of the more important things that I don't want to miss with either my team or my family so that if I do forget about something, somebody else is going to remind me that this is critical. So, you know, in the end, that's my sort of fail-safe, that as many reminders as I have about so-and-so's birthday is coming up, don't forget to send a present or organize this for the kids, or, you know, don't forget to call into this radio show. You know, you have people that really help you remember to keep on top of those kind of things. So, I wish I had a more magical answer, but for me, it's talking out loud, making sure I have good people surrounding me.
You know what? That's really important, and that works. There's something to be said letting others know what's going on so they can kind of have your back that way. My husband and I, we have a shared calendar. So literally, when there's something to do, I'll send a calendar invite, or he'll send a calendar invite. And we, that way we always know that, you know, if one misses it, the other person has it.
No, it's true. But, you know, sometimes I feel like my calendar gets so full with these things that don't really have a due date for them. Like, you know,
Right. Hey,
don't forget to, you know, enroll the kids in violin lessons, or I don't know, something like that, that you want to do and you want to remember it, but you don't know where to put it in your calendar. It's just something you should get around to doing. And those things just, you know, I tend to be an addict to sticky notes, even though,
oh my gosh,
so much smart support in the world, but I still feel like that paper stuff to my computer is going to be more effective.
That's funny. Well, you know what? I'm big on the sticky notes, and there are three sitting right next to me. But what I've also done, and these are just the three that, Deirdre, you better do this today or else. But I've also gotten into the habit of using note-taking software. So Evernote is really good for my lists of what I need to do. And if you just learn to incorporate that into your day at the beginning of the day, making sure to check, or the night before, that's where those reminders of, oh my gosh, this is due, that maybe have looser deadlines. And another one that's good is Wunderlist. So,
it's so funny. I just downloaded both of those apps yesterday.
Fantastic.
And I literally have not figured it out, but there was some article that I just read that said, you know, top 10 apps for keeping your life in order. And I said, oh, I need this.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No,
these are like probably 2 and 3. So I said, okay, I got to try these out. But I have not incorporated them. It's still like a routine kind of thing that you have to get used to. So,
yeah,
so we'll
it's
see.
Mindset.
We'll check in again in a month and see if I've done any better.
I bet you will. And we will definitely have this conversation again. Okay, so what about big challenges as a business owner? What's the biggest challenge, and how are you tackling it?
I think the biggest challenge changes every day. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest challenges is, you know, today you might have a recruiting issue where, you know, you're just not finding enough people to do whatever it is that you need to have done, or they're not the right quality people. And so you're really sort of, you know, problem solving that. And then when you feel like you have made some progress in it, you realize that you've sort of neglected your software and that there's a bug that you really have to deal with. And now there's that. So I think the challenge is learning how to prioritize things, but everything feels like an emergency. So trying to find some way to delegate and prioritize can be really maddening when you're sort of in the weeds. And, you know, like we've been talking about all along, these big companies tend to have a lot of people in different areas, almost a redundancy and an overlap, so that you can give things over to somebody and so stuff doesn't slip through the cracks. Well, in a small company, you may have two people running the entire marketing department. Believe me, something is going to fall through the cracks. So, trying to stay on top of all of those things and minimize the stress and frustration, I think that's the biggest thing is, how do you prioritize? What do we really need to get done today? Do we need to raise money today? Do we need to pay people today? What do we need to do today?
So I think that knowing the priorities are key, but something that you said about delegation, I find that many entrepreneurs that I talk to, and maybe it's just in the beginning as new business owners, they have a really hard time delegating. Do you fall into this category, or because you came out of, Wall Street and more corporate, an organization, a structure that it's easy to delegate?
I don't think it's ever easy to delegate something that you're so heavily invested in. So, even on Wall Street, there were people who this trade is so critically important to me, they wouldn't give any component of it over to the rest of the team. So I think it's a question of how much you believe in your team. So, I think I did everything in the beginning because I didn't have a team. And then when you slowly meet people who are incredibly talented and they love your vision, they support you, it's easy to give that over and say, I am not going to get very far all by myself. I need to believe in these people and I need to let them do their job. I did a good job hiring them. I need to let them run with it. Which is not to say you don't oversee it, obviously, but you're still really confident delegating and saying this is not something I need to micromanage. There are better things that I could be doing right now. Again, because we don't really have room for that overlap. You need to let the operations people run that. You need to let the software people run that. You need to let the marketing people run that so that they just can feel empowered to do what you hired them to do.
Oh, exactly. And let's face it, if you're hiring people and you're standing in the way of letting them, run with something that they're going to do well, that is the number one reason why your business would not grow, move to the next level.
Exactly.
Well, and it always does. It comes down to finding those right people. So here you are, you're working on your culture, you found the right people, you're moving forward. What project or projects that you're working on, what are you most proud of?
I guess I was most proud of, the first customer that I got who wasn't a friend of mine.
Oh, that's a great answer.
Kind of fun. They're tiny, tiny little victories in the beginning. Or you have such a small company. I mean, it's the modern day equivalent of the dollar that you frame, that you hang on the wall for your first resale purchase. But, I'm really proud of that. And that's just, an awesome victory. And then, you feel like there's this validation that, hey, I built this thing and somebody likes it. It's a huge, it's more of a vanity thing, but it really feels good. Other than that, I would say, wow. I think in retrospect, what I will be most proud of is a lot of this educational outreach that we're knee deep in the midst of doing right now. So really creating these thoughtful articles on why it's important to take care of your house, why the model that we've all had for, decades and decades of just waiting until something breaks for it to get fixed is dated, and we need to throw it out and we need to work toward a better future and a better outcome. I think that's something that I will be very proud of. And, it will be a validation of the idea if all of a sudden there's a bunch of competition for me out there, that it will imply that I'm right, that this is something that we needed to do. This is an evolution that needs to happen in homeownership. So I know that sounds kind of bizarre, but, I almost kind of welcome the competition because it is that shining example of what what you're trying to work toward is worth working toward, because other people see it now too.
Oh, exactly. And it says your market is growing, and you're going to grow with it. So I think that's make a really good point.
And that you're seeing something that wasn't previously there, that, you know, oh, this is a thing. This is what we should be doing. Of course it is.
Absolutely. You know, on the note, you made me laugh about how the first customer that wasn't your friend. I think that's great.
Sure, I'm telling you.
Yeah. How did that person actually find you? Was that just, you know, was it through a friend, or was it some marketing that you had done, a thought leadership?
I actually think it was through some marketing that we did. We had reached out to some brokers and telling them about the idea, and unbeknownst to us, one of these brokers has this weekly newsletter, and she was writing about what genius this was, that she had just heard about this company, and she, you know, wanted to tell everybody about it, and she wrote it up, and we had a whole bunch of people sign up as a result of that. So they were trusting the trusted resource that they had in this newsletter, this real estate person, and she, you know, just really sort of got the idea. So, you know, she's a customer too and a friend, but, you know, the fact that she went out and said this to, you know, couple hundred people who follow her newsletter was pretty cool.
Oh, that's a great endorsement. And let's face it, when anybody says
it's free, didn't cost anything. Hard to replicate as a marketing strategy, but it was very
exactly
cool.
Well, that's PR right there in the making. Right. And anytime somebody wants to use the word genius and tie that to what you're doing,
you cannot
ask for better.
Back to the proud moments, right?
Exactly. Okay, so what advice would you tell a younger professional, or maybe any professional who's looking to make some kind of a big change, kind of like what you did?
I would say that you have to be ready for failure. So, you know, don't do something assuming that it's going to succeed, because you will put a lot of things at risk as a result. So if your family cannot afford for you to be out of work if this doesn't work, this isn't probably the right choice for you to make. But if you're in a position where you can take that risk, it's so worthwhile. You will grow so much. It's a little bit like the advice people give to people considering whether or not they should have a baby. It will change your life. You will not be able to go back. You are completely altered as a result of being your own business owner, and all for the good, despite all of the, you know, challenges that it faces too. So I guess that's what I would say. If you're ready, if you feel like this is something that you can handle, and, you know, not for nothing, 90% of startups fail. But if you can handle the risk, the possibility that it doesn't work out, or if you can pivot, or if you have somebody supporting your back and it's time for you to be able to be that risk taker, then definitely do it. Jump in with both feet. You will love it.
Oh, yeah. That is really good advice. That statistic, 90%, is a little scary.
A little daunting. But yeah, it doesn't account for how many businesses fail quickly and then pivot and start and do something else.
Exactly.
So, you know, not everybody has invested their life savings in something that fails, but it's really meant to show that you can start a new business, but don't expect that it's necessarily going to be what you thought it was going to be in the beginning. So a lot of businesses will change because you haven't tested it. You don't know that because you created this genius new app that everybody and their dog is going to download it. You know, it's just one of those things. So you have to be ready to fail, and then you have to be ready to learn quickly from that failure. They always say fail fast if you're going to fail, so that you can pick up and turn 90 degrees and figure out what the next angle is.
Exactly. Fail fast, pivot, and move forward. Well, great advice. Last question, super easy. Where can my listeners find out more about you and Glass House?
Glasshouse.com. Very easy to go in and see all kinds of information about us. Our blog has tons of tips and advice on home maintenance and all kinds of stuff. There's a history of my team in our About section, lots and lots of great information there.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for sharing your journey, all of your insights. I hope that homeowners listening will think about their investments and hopefully reach out. So, you know,
that would be great. Well, and they're welcome to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. There's all kinds of stuff we post all the time about new advice. And like, we just really want to help homeowners take care of their homes.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Deirdre.
You're welcome. I also want to thank all of you for tuning into Women Worldwide. Until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.
You have been listening to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge, brought to you by Pure Performance Communications on the socialnetworkstation.com. You can reach Pure Performance at www.pureperformancecom.com. Women Worldwide is produced by SNI, and the opinions of the hosts and guests do not necessarily reflect those of Social Network Intermedia, LLC, or the Social Network Station.